Well, thank you all for coming. And when we say that the Bolivarian revolution that is taking place in Venezuela is relevant for the trade union movement, for the youth movement, for the struggles in other countries, I would like to start by giving one example, which is that on May Day, the Venezuelan government took advantage of Labor Day, International Workers' Day, to announce a number of very progressive measures. And amongst these measures, there are some changes in the labor law, in labor legislation, which I think are very, very important, not only for Venezuela, but relevant for many other countries, I think including Canada. One of these is the banning of temporary work agencies. This means that, which exist in many countries around the world, which are based on this principle that one works for the temporary work agency is sent to work in a workplace, but this person hasn't got the same rights, collective bargaining agreement, trade union rights, and so on, than other workers in the same place where he's working, because he is formally employed by a temporary work agency. This is from now on forbidden in Venezuela. It was a big form of employment and attacking trade union and workers' rights. Second thing that was taken off the statutes was a type of contract that was called training contract for young people between 18 and 25 years of age, in which the employers were allowed to pay young workers under the minimum legal minimum wage, which I think is a thing that also exists in many other countries. These are just two indications of things that the Venezuelan government is introducing that are very, very relevant to discussions that are taking place in the labor movement, struggles that are happening, like, for instance, a recent struggle in France against the contract of first employment and so on. Now, the reason why we set up the campaign back in 2002 was the main and first reason why we established the campaign was because we saw that most of the information that was being printed in the mass media internationally about Venezuela was not only distorted, was in most cases the opposite to the truth. In fact, in the first months of the campaign, we developed an equation that if you wanted to know what was really happening in Venezuela, you had to pick up a mainstream media newspaper and turn what they were saying 180 degrees to the opposite direction. You will be very, very close to the truth. And in fact, when I was first visiting Venezuela, first time I was flying to Venezuela from Spain on an Air France flight, I was given a newspaper, sometimes they do in planes. And this newspaper is one of the main mainstream newspapers in Spain, El País. And I was reading, this was December 2002, I was reading about Venezuela, where there was allegedly a workers' strike, workers' demonstrations, against an unpopular government that was using authoritarian measures against the labor movement. And not only this, but as a result of this strike, the whole country was paralyzed, including the cancellation of all international flights into the Caracas airport of Maiquetía. So I got really worried because I was on a plane that was going to Maiquetía. I didn't know what was going to happen, but nothing happened. The plane landed in Maiquetía Airport. It was working normally. Planes from all countries were landing in the airport. Then we took public transport to go to Caracas, which is 1 hour away, where the underground system, public transport system, electricity, everything was working more or less normally. And there was no workers' strike. There was sabotage of the economy organized by the employers and the managers of the state-owned oil company. And there was no authoritarian government, but it was the most democratic government there's ever been in Venezuela. So this is one of the reasons why we decided to start the campaign. First of all, to spread truthful information and news about what is really happening in Venezuela. But on the other hand, we were not surprised about this media campaign of lies, disinformation, because what is happening in Venezuela is a revolution. And a revolution is a dangerous thing for those who hold the positions of privilege, of power, of economic power, and so on around the world. And these are the same people who own the media outlets, the newspapers, the TV stations, and they are not interested in people around the world knowing about the revolution in Venezuela, just in case they take it as an example and organize a revolution in their own countries. Now, the movement in Venezuela has had a number of turning points. I don't know how familiar you all are with the movement in Venezuela, But you could say that one of the main turning points was 1989, on the 27th of February, recently elected government of Carlos Andrés Pérez decided to, 1 week into office, decided to introduce a massive package of neoliberal measures, which included the lifting of subsidies to basic food products, lifting of subsidies to fuel, and the consequent increase of prices of public transport that went up by 3 times, and so on. Immediately, the population in Venezuela reacted in a spontaneous way with a massive uprising that was known as El Caracazo. But the uprising was not only limited to Caracas, it took place in many cities around the country. And it was a basic instinctive movement against these neoliberal measures. The government of Carlos Andrés Pérez reacted in a very brutal way. He suspended all constitutional guarantees, all democratic rights were suspended for about a week. It was a state of siege declared, and they sent the army to fire on the unarmed demonstrators. Up until this day, it is not still known how many people died, because they were buried in mass graves, unmarked, and so on. And the lower estimates talk of about 1,000 dead. The higher estimates talk about 3,000-4,000 people were killed, assassinated brutally by the government at that time. This was a major turning point, because it meant the end of what was called the Punto Fijo Agreement, or the Punto Fijo system, which had ruled the country for 40 years. And the main basis of this agreement that had been established in 1961 was the two main parties, a kind of social democratic party, Acción Democrática, and the Christian Democratic Party, COPEI, were ruling the country and were dividing power and alternating in power. In fact, it was formally a democracy, but it was very far from being democratic. There was no alternative for people. And these two parties divided between themselves all positions of power in the judiciary, amongst public civil servants, and so on, for 40 years. And anybody who dissented from this will be put in jail. For instance, in the trade unions, these were very, very far from being trade union, real trade unions. They were more like mafia-type trade unionism, in which ADE, this party, would control everything. People would dissent, would be sacked from their jobs, and or killed sometimes. And by 1989, by the government using this massive repression against unarmed demonstrators, for the majority of Venezuelans, this was the end of this any legitimacy of this kind of system had left at that time. In 1992, a group of young officers from the army, led by Hugo Chavez, who was then mostly unknown, decided to rebel against this system and try to organize an uprising within the military, with the hope that people will also rise up, join them, and they will overthrow this system and change fundamentally the situation. The military uprising failed, and Chavez went into jail together with some of his comrades in arms. But it was also another important turning point, February the 4th, 1992. Chavez became a very popular figure, because up until that time, I mean, many people identified the army as the people who had fired on the unarmed population. A few years after, because of popular pressure, Chavez was released from jail, and there was a big debate within his movement that had already started when he was in jail, about whether to stand in the elections or not. There were some people who said that it was worthless, it was pointless to stand in those elections. But finally, those who argued to stand in the elections won the debate, and Chavez stood in the 1998 presidential elections. These elections were extremely polarized. There were, by the end of it, there were only two real candidates. One candidate that had the support of all the traditional political parties, the hierarchy of the Catholic Church, the whole of the mass media, private and publicly owned, the US Embassy. All the real powers in society were supporting the anti-Chavez candidate. And Chavez was only supported by a mass movement that had been built over this election campaign. And he was completely demonized. They said that Chavez was a communist, that he was an atheist, that if he came to power, chaos will follow, and so on. But nevertheless, he won by a big majority, 58% of the votes, a little bit more than 58% of the votes he won in 98. And this was a major turning point, because for many people it was not only just a normal presidential election, but for the mass movement that was behind Chavez, this was the beginning of something new, the beginning of, for the first time, the opportunity of ordinary Venezuelan people to take the future into their own hands and change it in a way that they wanted. At the beginning, the ruling elite, the oligarchy that had ruled the country for hundreds of years in Venezuela, had an ambivalent position in relation to Chavez. They didn't want him to win the election, but once he won, they said, well, maybe this is just one other of these guys that comes into office with lots of promises. We'll try to buy him off, moderate his more radical language, and it'll be all right. And for a period of about 1 year, 1 year and a half, they were trying to do that. And in fact, at least one big media group supported Chavez at the beginning. The Cisneros family had certain relations with Chavez, and they hoped that Chavez will come to power, and then he will be moderated under pressure and so on. But they were proven wrong, because Chavez stuck to his program and started to implement it. And the most important thing was not even so much the measures that he was implementing, but the mass movement that was being created around Chavez. You know, Chavez started with a weekly radio broadcast, which then became a weekly TV broadcast. And this was an exercise in mass political education of the Venezuelan people. I've seen some of these programs, and they're really, really quite good. I mean, in one of them, for instance, he came in front of a map of the country, and he started pointing out. He said, well, Venezuela is a very rich country. It's a very wealthy country. Here we have oil in this place, in this place, in this place. We also have mineral resources. We have diamonds. We have gold. We have very fertile land. And then he said, and the only reason why a majority of Venezuelan people live under the poverty line is because this wealth is in the hands of a privileged minority. We must put these resources to work for the benefit of the majority of the population. This, which is quite simple idea, became a very revolutionary idea, because it's very dangerous for that wealthy minority, that privileged minority that control these natural resources for a very long time, for 100 years, for 200 years. Practically since independence. In December 2001, Chavez passed 49 enabling laws, 49 decrees, over major points of policy. Probably the most important ones were three, one in relation to land reform, instituting land reform so that any private land that was not being used, that was left idle, could be expropriated and distributed to the peasants. This was very important in a country like Venezuela that imports 70% of the food that it consumes. This just gives you an indication of the really parasitical nature of the ruling elite in Venezuela, because Venezuela is a very fertile country with very fertile land, very favorable weather. Nevertheless, since oil was discovered, agriculture was completely abandoned, and the 5% of land owners that own about 80-85% of all land, they were just leaving this land idle, while the country was importing all sorts of products, from basic foodstuffs to meat and so on. Second measure, second important measure, was the fishing law, which protected small artisan fishermen as opposed to the big industrial fishing operations that were destroying the natural resources of the sea. And the third and probably the most important law was the hydrocarbons law, the law on oil and gas, which reasserted the nationalized character and the state-owned character of oil industry. Many people think that Chavez nationalized the oil industry, but this is not the case. The oil industry in Venezuela was nationalized in 1976 by the first Carlos Andrés Pérez, and it had been nationalized ever since. But the small problem is that in a country like Venezuela, where oil plays such a big role in the economy and in the state revenues, what had happened is that within the oil company, a massive bureaucracy had emerged, which had become like a state within the state. The PDVSA, state-owned oil company, probably had more power than the actual elected president. And this bureaucracy at the head of this company was running the company in their own interest. They were pocketing quite a lot of the money, as has been now proven. But they were also running it in the interest of the multinationals, with the idea of progressively privatizing the company and part of its operations and so on. So Chavez basically passed a law that said this nationalization must remain, and even if there are any concessions to foreign private companies, this should be on the basis of 51% state ownership of any oil operations in the country. And then he moved to remove some of the directors at the head of this state-owned oil company, which he was in his right to do, as this is a state-owned oil company, and he was the president of the country. This was the turning point at which the opposition started to organize a military coup against Chavez. Large coalition was put together, organized, financed, and funded, and coordinated through the U.S. Embassy in Venezuela, which comprised the heads of these mafia-type trade unions, the heads of the Employers' Federation, the hierarchy of the Catholic Church, all the media groups in the country, and they started a campaign of demonization against Chavez, campaign of demonstrations against the government, and finally, in April 2002, they organized a military coup against Chavez. Now, this so far is not an unknown story in Latin America. In the 1970s, there were plenty of left-wing governments elected to office, some more radical, some less radical. They tried to implement a number of progressive measures, and they were all overthrown by military coups organized from Washington. In fact, many of the people who organized some of those coups in the 1970s are now in charge of U.S. Latin America policy, and they are exactly the same people who organized the military coup in Venezuela, people like Otto Reich, John Negroponte, Roger Noriega, Peter de Chasso. These people were directly involved in the military coup in Chile, in the different covert CIA operations in Central America in the 1980s, in El Salvador, in Nicaragua, Honduras, and so on. And they are exactly the same individuals who are running the Latin American policy of the United States right now. So as I say, this was not a new story. It was a military coup. What was new, surprising, and I think is almost unprecedented, is that this coup was defeated in less than 48 hours by a spontaneous mass movement of the people in the streets. And this is why I say that the Chavez government is not only or even so much about the measures that the government introduced, but about what it created from below. Mass revolutionary movement in which hundreds of thousands, probably millions of people, became organized and politicized, politically aware, for the first time in their lives. There's hundreds of thousands of organizations, Bolivarian circles, land reform committees in the cities and in the countryside, water committees, democratic trade unions, youth organizations, Bolivarian fronts, popular assemblies, all sorts of organizations that reflected the will of the majority of poor people, workers, peasants, and poor people in the cities to change their lives. And this was a really powerful force that at this time could not be stopped. And it was a force that had not been foreseen by the opposition. They had everything controlled. They had everything organized. Some people today say that the coup failed because it was badly organized. But this is not true. The coup was very well organized, and as I said, the people who organized the coup have quite a lot of experience of organizing coups in the past. And they did everything that has to be done in order to organize a coup. In fact, in this coup, nobody knew that this had been a coup, because the story that had been put out by all the media was that Chavez had resigned after he had ordered the troops to fire on unarmed opposition protesters. This was completely false, but this was the only version that was broadcasted by the mass media. Nevertheless, the people didn't believe it. And if you look at some of the documentaries, there's even people in those documentaries saying, well, even if the president has resigned, we don't accept his resignation. We elected him. He is accountable to us. We don't accept his resignation. What this shows is precisely this, that what is happening in Venezuela is not just a progressive government introducing some progressive measures, which is happening. It's a revolution. That is, the mass of the people normally stay away from politics, participating directly in deciding over their own future. And this is a very powerful force, as I say, which stopped the coup. Hundreds of thousands of people came out on the streets. They gathered outside the main military barracks in Fuerte Tiuna in Caracas, in the 42nd Parachute Division in Maracay. And through this mass mobilization of unarmed people, they managed to turn some of the military officers on the side of Chavez, some who were wavering, some who were loyal to Chavez but didn't know what to do. And in less than 48 hours, Chavez was returned to power. In one of those documentaries, which is on sale at the back, you can see some images from those days, and it's really, really impressive. You see, for instance, 100,000 people outside the Maracay 42nd Parachute Division with their fists raised, shouting, "The People United will never be defeated." They were really, really confident, and they didn't want to miss this one opportunity in their lives of changing something, of being protagonists of some radical change. And yes, it's true, the coup was defeated in less than 48 hours. What happened afterwards was quite interesting, in fact. Interesting in relation to Chavez's political thinking, his personality, his approach to politics. He said, he came out in the balcony, and the first thing he did, after he'd just been removed by a military coup, first thing he did was to appeal for people to go back to their homes, to appeal for calm, and for national reconciliation. He even called on to the opposition, etc., just organized a military uprising against his presidency to come onto negotiating tables and so on. In fact, for many years, nobody was prosecuted in Venezuela for the coup, because in August 2002, the Supreme Court passed a ruling saying there had been no coup in the country. All these judges who had been put in by Adea and Copei in the previous period, they said there had been no coup. What happened in the country was that there had been a vacuum of power, and this vacuum of power had been filled in by Pedro Carmona, president of Employers Federation, which just happened to pass by and was called in to fill this vacuum of power. Now, this is a story that might seem funny. It is quite funny. But this is actually what he said in the hearing in Parliament when there was a commission of inquiry about the coup. So as I say, far from being an authoritarian government, what Chavez was being criticized by many in the Bolivarian movement was for being too lenient on the opposition after the coup. You know, I mean, in most countries, you organize a military coup, you are put on trial and go to jail for a number of years. And that was even Chavez's own experience in 92. But the opposition was not moved by this appeal to national unity or anything like that. They had very clear ideas about what was happening in the country. They feared this revolution, and rightly so. They feared losing their power and privileges that they had maintained for so many years, and they moved immediately to organize another coup. And they thought that, well, I mean, this country is based on oil, the oil industry, so we're gonna hit the oil industry. So from December, I think it was December the 2nd or December the 10th, I can't remember very well, they started to organize sabotage of the oil economy. They called for a general strike, but this was no general strike. In fact, it was a boss's lockout. That is, the workers didn't want to go on strike, but went to the factories in many instances and found the gates locked. And in many factories, I witnessed how mass meetings of the workers decided to took a formal vote that they wanted to work, that they were not in favor of this work stoppage, and that unless the employers opened the gates again, they will occupy the factories. And many of these factories were opened straight away for fear of being occupied by the workers. So this was no worker strike, it was a boss's lockout. And particularly, it hit particularly hard the oil company, where the managers, all the managerial layers, the directors, the higher paid engineers and so on, they decided to sabotage the operation. This was a well-prepared plan. had been in preparation for a number of weeks and months, and they basically destroyed quite a lot of the installations. They took away the computerized passwords. They jammed some of the valves, and I don't know if anybody here is familiar with the oil industry, but obviously this is a very delicate operation. It's also highly developed from a technological point of view, so by destroying a few computer systems, you paralyze quite a lot of processes in the industry. But then again, the most surprising thing happened. Communities came out and surrounded the oil installations. They kicked out the saboteurs. And the workers, ordinary rank-and-file workers, many of them, went back, took over the installations one by one over a period of a few weeks, and they started to run them under workers' control, without managers, without directors, which had left the positions and sabotaged the economy. And not only this, they started to recover production. And they went through many complicated processes, and they used their own ideas, and this was very important. And over a period of 63 days, which the lockout lasted, the workers managed to recover production in the oil industry up to 3 million barrels of oil a day. And finally, the opposition gave up and they said, "Well, we lost." And I think it was in February the 2nd, they declared that the strike was over. The strike that never actually happened, but anyway, they declared it over. This is a very important turning point, in my opinion, because here we have an example of workers' control, workers' management, not in a small textile factory, abandoned textile factory, say, but in what is one of the largest companies in Latin America, one of the world's biggest companies, and one that, as I said, is very developed from a technological point of view. Many processes, as I said, are computerized, run through satellite systems and so on. And they proved this. And this, I must say as well, that these workers, the oil workers, were not particularly the most advanced section of the labor movement in Venezuela. They had the last national strike in 1936. And since the ruling class became so worried about the oil workers and the power of the oil workers, they had a deliberate policy to buy off the oil workers. They had wages that were much higher than any other section of the working class. They had conditions that were far apart, put them far apart from the rest of the working class. And they were basically a privileged layer, had been bought off. And deliberate policy of separating them from the rest of the labor movement, from the rest of the working class. And in 24 hours, they turned into the most advanced section. And there was one thing that the workers learned in this period. Not during the actual period of workers' control, but afterwards, there were many discussions, national oil workers' congresses and meetings and debates. And the one thing that was the dominant conclusion that they drew was, if the oil workers can run PDVSA, the workers in Venezuela can run any part of the economy, because this is the most important industry in the land. This is a very advanced conclusion, and one that put the fear into the minds of the employers throughout the country. As a result of this, the government recovered control over the oil industry and started using the oil resources in order to implement a program of massive social plans. You see, in 1976, when the oil industry had been nationalized, 80% of revenues of the oil industry will revert to the state, 20% will be for running costs of the industry. By 2001, it was precisely the opposite. 80% was kept in the company for running costs, that is theft by the managers and directors, and 20% only was reverting to the state. Massive amount of money was liberated that was then immediately used for social programs. Now, some people say, even unfortunately, someone who consider themselves to be on the left, that Hugo Chavez is a populist. Now, in general, the politics of populism are based on the idea of distributing money to the people in order to buy them off and organize them in neatly controlled organizations controlled by the government. Now, in Venezuela, it's precisely the opposite. The government is using quite a lot of money for these social programs, but the social programs, without exception, are run by the people themselves. So in one community, if they want to get literacy campaign, they have to look for a place where they're going to have the teachers. They have to look for they have to organize themselves, and then the state gives them the necessary resources. But this is linked to self-organization of the communities. And these programs have been extremely successful. And I think that they are very, very relevant also for other countries that consider themselves to be richer and are applying precisely the opposite policies. In Venezuela now, there's a campaign to get 200,000 new university places for university students free of charge and aimed mainly at the students from poor backgrounds. From working class families, from poor families that have been traditionally excluded from the higher education system. In Venezuela, they have implemented a plan for eradicating illiteracy, which culminated last year in October with a formal declaration of Venezuela as a territory free from illiteracy. 1.8 million people have been lifted out of illiteracy thanks to this program in about 2 years. And there is a massive program of healthcare, by which primary basic healthcare is being provided in the poor areas in Caracas and outside through the program which is called Barrio Adentro, with a collaboration of about 15 to 20,000 Cuban doctors and nurses have gone and staffed these primary healthcare centers at the beginning, while Cuban doctors and nurses are trained into this new type of healthcare, which is basic primary healthcare, rather than healthcare for the rich and wealthy. This obviously solidified mass support for the Chavez government. But, I don't have time to go into all the details. There was a recall referendum in August 2004. A whole number of other things happened. But I wanted to concentrate on what has happened over the last 1 year, in 2005. Because 2005 has been a year in which the revolution has accelerated and a whole number of new elements have been added onto the equation. The first one of these, which I think is very, very significant, is when, at the end of January 2005, Chavez made an important speech which explained his change of political thinking. He said, and this is a straight quote from this speech which he made at the World Social Forum, he said, "At the beginning, I thought that the third way was possible, because in fact, in 1998, he visited Britain after he was elected, and he met with Tony Blair, and Tony Blair told him about the third way, and Chavez said, well, that sounds like a good idea. It sounds good, third way is not one thing or the other, so let's try to implement it. Let's try to have," he said, "I thought that we could implement all these reforms within the limits of capitalism," he says, "but now I have come to the conclusion that within the limits of capitalism, it is not possible to solve the problems of inequality, misery, and poverty of the Venezuelan that face the Venezuelan masses. This is only possible to do it by going beyond capitalism. You cannot go beyond capitalism from within capitalism. You must overcome capitalism, and the only way forward is socialism." And he added, "Socialism, I don't mean like socialism of the 20th century. We must learn from the mistakes that were made in the 20th century. We must go to socialism of the 21st century, which must be based on revolutionary democracy." Now, I think that this is pretty significant in itself. For the first time since the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, here we have a head of elected head of state, of who is also the head of mass revolutionary movement, posing the question that within the limits of capitalism, we cannot really solve these problems. And he is also someone who has actually tried to do it. I mean, they tried to introduce a number of reforms, as I said, healthcare, education for all, doing away with the bureaucracy, national control of oil resources. These, which apparently don't go against the capitalist system as such, in principle, and he didn't say, let's go and nationalize all private property of the means of production. He didn't say that. It was not in his program. It's not even in his program now. But the result of this, trying to apply these reforms, these progressive reforms, was that the whole of the capitalist class in Venezuela organized a mass armed uprising against his government. So therefore, he drew the conclusion, well, within the limits of capitalism, we can't solve these problems. This is a good example. I mean, if you want a place where someone has really tried genuinely to reform capitalism, to make it capitalism with a human face, or whatever you want to call it, is Venezuela, and they have failed, not because not for lack of trying, because the capitalist class cannot even accept these moderate reforms at this particular time. So this is one point. And this debate about socialism has now permeated the whole of society. In fact, last year, on these dates, 19th of April is anniversary of the independence, and General Miller Rojas made a speech, the order of the day speech to the armed forces, and he said, well, we must bring the debate about socialism within the armed forces. We've been trained to think that socialism is bad, that communism is bad, but we must rethink all. We must bring the debate into the armed forces about socialism. Everywhere people are talking about socialism. Even the head of the Employers' Federation, at the last national meeting, they had a debate about socialism of the 21st century. What does it mean for the employers? So obviously, the debate is open. But socialism means different things for different people. There's even people within the government who have publicly stated that for them socialism is like social democracy, that is, few reforms within capitalism, social welfare state, blah, blah, blah. There are other people who have more radical ideas about what socialism means. But the very fact that the debate has been open and that it is now permeating the whole of society is already quite a big step forward. And the debate has also penetrated the labor movement, and this is probably the most important point. Now then, in the end of January, Chavez also took another measure which has opened a new debate, and this measure is the nationalization of Venepal paper mill in Morón, in the state of Carabobo. Now this paper mill had been closed down by its owners in the spring of 2003 as part of a campaign of economic sabotage against the Chavez government. The idea is that we close the factories, we declare them bankrupt, and we turn the workers against the government because the government is to blame for this economic situation which has forced us to close the factories. But what happened in Venepal was that the workers occupied the factory twice. First time they occupied the factory in August 2003 for about 3 months. They ran it under workers' control much more efficiently. And then they reached a settlement with the employers. The employers came back. But the second time round, when they tried the same trick of declaring the company bankrupt, the workers occupied the factory and demanded that the government expropriated the factory and give it to them for under workers' management. If the employers don't want to run the companies, we'll run them in the interest of the majority of the Venezuelan people. This was the idea. The most surprising thing was not the idea in itself. There's been other struggles for expropriation, for nationalization, and the workers' control, and so on. But the fact that Chavez did actually carry this out. The 19th of January 2005, this is about one year and a bit ago, he had a meeting in a room like this. Only the room was in the presidential palace, where about 400 workers were present, and he read the decree for the nationalization of the company. And he made a number of points at this meeting, which are very relevant, which have now been discussed throughout the labor movement. First point he made is that we don't want nationalization that means state capitalism. That is, we don't want just to change from a private employer to a state-owned employer, because this has been tried in the past. In Venezuela, in the 1970s, there was a lot of state-owned companies were developed, because private capitalism was not developing the economy, so the state tried to kickstart the economy, create steel industry, aluminium, and so on. We don't want that, he said. What we want is for the workers to run these companies. So this is the first interesting element. Second interesting element, he said that this should serve as an example for other groups of workers in other places. So this opened a movement for factory occupations and for expropriations. Now, there's been a movement like this, for instance, in Argentina in recent times. There's about, I think, 200 factories that have been occupied in Argentina and different stages of workers' control, workers' management, and so on. But when some of these workers in Argentina came to Venezuela in October last year in a Latin American-wide meeting of worker-recovered factories, they said one very significant thing. They said, well, I mean, in our country, we occupy the factories, and the government, Kirchner government, sends the police, sends the judges, and tries to evict the workers from these factories by force, by illegal means, and so on. In Venezuela, it's the opposite way. The workers occupy the factories, and the government sends the National Guard to protect the workers from the higher tax from the old owners. And in fact, Chavez, in July last year, he read in his weekly broadcast, Hello Presidente, he read a list, well, he didn't read the whole list, but he presented a list, and he read some cases, of 1,200 companies that were either completely idle, abandoned, or semi-paralyzed. And he said that the workers must take over these factories. If the employees don't want to run the economy, the workers will run them. And the government will legalize this situation. This has kick-started a movement of factory occupations, quite logically. And this movement of factory occupations has not limited itself to factories that have been closed down. But now, in any labor dispute about any issue, immediately the issue of occupation comes up. The workers say, okay, well, we've been through the negotiation procedures, we've been to the labor courts, we don't achieve anything, we occupy the factory, and unless the bosses give in to our fair and just demands, then we'll run the factory ourselves. Which is quite an important step forward, which is now being discussed throughout the labor movement. And there is one additional thing that happened last year that I think is quite important, that is that in the month of April, I think it was, well, a number of other factories have been expropriated. This is still, to be fair, quite a small movement that involves a small number of factories with a small number of workers. But in my opinion, it's quite significant over the debates that are taking place within the labor movement and the direction that the whole movement is taking. Now, in April last year, as I was saying, there was another development. A new director was appointed at the head of this aluminium smelter in Bolivar, which is called Alcasa, state-owned aluminium smelter with about 1,600 workers, 1,800. And he came in. This guy, Carlos Lanz, is a former guerrilla activist. He considers himself to be a Marxist. And he has always been very much in favor, arguing for workers' control, workers' management, and so on. So he came into this company, and first thing, together with some of the labor activists in this factory, organized a mass meeting of all the workers. First thing he said was, this factory is now going to start an experience of workers' control. And I am going to be the last director of this company elected, appointed by the government. The next one will be elected by the Workers' General Assembly once we finish this process. And so the process has started, and all the old managerial layers have been removed. And in the place where before there was a manager, three workers have been elected. These workers are elected by the assembly of the workers in that particular section of the factory. They are recallable. They are accountable to the assembly. They are recallable at any time when 70% of the workers who elected them vote for recall. And they don't receive any wage privileges. They just receive some time off release to carry out their duties, managerial duties. This is a very advanced experience of workers' control, which is not without contradictions, obviously. There's many contradictions. There's people who are interested in this process failing, so that then they can say, well, told you so, the workers can't run the factories. And they are sabotaging the whole process. But the process has started, and it's now spreading to other factories like Benalum, Cable Loom, and other factories in the same kind of complex of basic industries in the state of Bolivar, in Puerto Ordaz. And so this is also a very interesting debate that is taking place. Now, the last thing I wanted to say is this, that as the revolution advances, moves forward, and generates more radical debates and demands, the revolution becomes more dangerous for the owners of industry, the owners of banks, the owners of the land, the owners of the multinationals, the United States, and so on. So therefore, the fact that the counter-revolution has been defeated on at least three decisive occasions, during the coup, during the bosses' lockout, sabotage of the oil economy, and during the referendum, doesn't mean that they are not dangerous. They are, at this particular time, weaker than they were, say, in 2002. In 2002, the opposition was able to mobilize large numbers of people, hundreds of thousands, in the streets of Caracas against the government. The Bolivarian movement was able to mobilize 1 million people, 2 million people, but that was not reported in the international media. But now, the revolution is still able to mobilize large numbers of people, has solidified a massive amount of support, but the opposition, the counter-revolution, is not able to mobilize anybody on the streets. I mean, for May Day, for instance, they tried this year to organize a May Day demonstration. They got about 2,000 people. At the Bolivarian demonstration organized by the National Union of Workers, the New Trade Union Confederation, there were hundreds of thousands. I mean, I've been talking to some comrades who were down there and say it's very difficult to calculate, but there must have been 200,000, 300,000 people at the May Day rally. Now, as I said, the fact that they are weaker in the sense of they have less points of support in the army, they have less capability of mass mobilization, doesn't make them less dangerous. For instance, there's a number of things that they've been discussing, like the possibility of a political assassination of Chavez in the hope that this will disorganize the movement. The possible military provocations in the border with Colombia, in the state of Zulia, for instance, fostering a so-called independence movement for Zulia in order to provide justification or an excuse for a military intervention under the banner of humanitarian peacekeeping or something like that, and so on. They are organizing, and for instance, as we speak, there is big military maneuvers organized by the United States in the Caribbean, which are called Partnership for the Americas, and involve USS Washington, which is an aircraft carrier with 60 fighter planes, about 6,500 troops. They are doing the rounds around in the Caribbean. At the same time that this is happening, the Foreign Affairs Ministry of Holland has said that they are worried because Venezuela is going to invade Aruba and Curaçao, the two islands off the coast, when in fact Aruba and Curaçao are basically military bases for the United States. So, I mean, it's the opposite thing. And there's just one other interesting thing. You know, one of the aims, stated aims of these military maneuvers, Partnership for the Americas, is to fight against narco-trafficking. At the same time that they are supposed to be fighting against narco-trafficking in the Caribbean, this massive seizure of cocaine takes place in Mexico. I think it's about 5 million tons of cocaine. That's quite a large amount. This cocaine was coming from Colombia through Venezuela into Mexico. Immediate headlines in all the serious newspapers, including the Financial Times, this proves that Venezuela is a major, is now a major point of travel for drugs going into United States and Europe, blah, blah, blah. And so it's preparing the ground for military intervention. They'll find one excuse or another. In fact, at one point they were even saying that there was an Al-Qaeda training base in the Margarita Island. The Margarita Island, for those who know, is a nice tourist resort where Islamic fundamentalists will really stand out, you know. I mean, it's the last place where they will probably be training. But going back to this seizure of drugs in Mexico, what the papers forgot to report was not in the U.S. Press releases or anything like that, was the reason why the Mexican authorities were able to seize this plane that was coming from Venezuela was because the Venezuelan authorities had tipped off the Mexican authorities. So Venezuela was collaborating in the struggle against narco trafficking, but it's turned into its opposite. It's turned into Venezuela is a major country where drugs go through. So there is a big campaign in the media of preparing the ground for something. Eventually, they will find the right time to do it. In fact, in my opinion, the opinion of many of us in the campaign, if it wasn't for the war in Iraq, if it wasn't for the fact that the United States is bogged down in a war in Iraq that they cannot win, with I think it's 200,000 troops, if I'm not wrong, they will have already invaded Venezuela. Because Venezuela is the third largest supplier of oil to the United States, and this is obviously very important for the United States. But this is not the only reason, not only the oil, which is very important, it's also the threat of bad example. For the United States administration, Venezuela is a really bad example. And you can see what's happening throughout Latin America, quite independently of what was already happening in Venezuela. This is a mass wave of sharpening movements, of increased confidence of the workers and peasants throughout the continent, which massive shift to the left, which has expressed in different ways in different countries, the election of left-wing governments, or governments that are seen as being better or more left-wing, mass general strikes, overthrow of governments in Argentina, in Ecuador, in Bolivia, in a whole number of countries. If to this you add a successful revolutionary movement in Venezuela, then you have a very explosive combination. Just a few days ago, on Monday, the Bolivian government decided to nationalize the gas resources in the country, and they sent the army into the gas fields in order to take them over. Now, this is not a full-scale nationalization. There's many ins and outs in the legal aspects of it, but this is quite a high-profile decision to send the army into the gas fields to ensure that the state has control over these important natural resources, which are in the hands of the multinationals. This will not have happened in Bolivia, which is, after all, a very weak, indebted country, if they didn't know that they had the backing of Venezuela. That Venezuela has proven, by example, that this can be done, that the natural resources of one country can be used for the benefit of the overwhelming majority of the people and not for the benefit of a wealthy minority. So this is very dangerous for the United States, and they will not stop until they try again to organize a coup, overthrow, or political assassination. And they got plenty of people who are prepared to do it. This is why solidarity is so important. But from our point of view, solidarity in the case of Venezuela is not only us organizing a solidarity movement with Venezuela, but also us learning quite a lot from what is happening in Venezuela. The debate about workers' control is relevant to other countries where jobs are being destroyed, factories are being closed. The debate about free education, free university education for all, it's quite relevant to many other countries where the trend is for increase of tuition fees. The debate about free health care for all is also relevant for many other countries where health care is being slashed or privatized or partially privatized and so on, or its funds being cut. So this is the situation. And we think it's very, very exciting. Revolution in Venezuela has not finished, in my opinion. It has started, has been quite successful up until this point, but it has not finished. And one last danger that I will mention is this, that it's happened in other revolutions at other times in history. When they cannot launch a frontal assault against the revolution, counter-revolutionary forces base themselves, lean on the more moderate elements within the Bolivarian movement, in order to stop the revolution from going any further, from taking over, really, control over the whole of the economy, which is the task that is left in Venezuela, which has not been accomplished. I mean, in Venezuela, for instance, food distribution is still controlled by two monopoly groups, the Cisneros and the Polar, which are the main backers and people who funding the opposition attempts. So this is quite dangerous. The banking system is controlled 80% by two Spanish multinational banks, Banco Bilbao Vizcaya and Banco Central Hispano Santander Atlantico, something else, because there's been a process of concentration of the banks in Spain as well. So this is also quite dangerous. These banks are in private hands, not only in private hands, but in hands of people who are subsidizing and financing the counter-revolution in Venezuela, against the wishes of the majority of the population. So the revolution has not been completed, and there are people within the Bolivarian movement who are either consciously or unconsciously playing a negative role in relation to this when they say, no, the revolution must moderate, we shouldn't go any further, this is already too much. And there is a perception within the Bolivarian movement that there is a bureaucracy within the Bolivarian movement, particularly at the top, that is preventing the whole movement from going any further. And in many of the demands that are coming up from the mass movement below, in the last period particularly, so not only the struggle against the counter-revolution, but also the struggle against the counter-revolutionaries within the Bolivarian movement, what they call the squalidos con boina roja, people who are opposition supporters, but they put on the red beret, which is the symbol of the revolution, and then they pass on as revolutionaries while they are sabotaging the revolution from within. This is also a big danger that is present in Venezuela. I mean, I've already spoken for quite a long time. My voice is going, and I'm sure you also have a lot of questions and contributions, points of view that you would like to express. But I'll just finish by saying this, that in my opinion, I've been involved in politics for quite a long time. And this is probably one of the most exciting things, not only Venezuela, what is happening around the world, one of the most exciting times in the last, say, 20 years. You know, when the mass movements around the world are advancing, feeling more confident, There are revolutionary movements, there are general strikes, unpopular governments are being overthrown, and so on. And therefore, this is a crucial moment. A defeat for the Venezuelan revolution is a defeat for the movement around the world. It will have a demoralizing effect in many other places. A victory for the Venezuelan revolution will also have an encouraging effect in many other countries in the struggles that we are waging in our own countries for many other different things. And as many of the, we've brought speakers from Venezuela to meetings around the world, and the one thing that they always say is, look, the best way you can help the Bolivarian revolution is to set the conditions in your own countries for similar revolutions to take place in your own countries. That is fundamental radical change which puts the country's natural resources, the country's economy, in the hands of its own people, working people, mass of the population, instead of being in the hands of a small, wealthy, privileged minority that have been controlling these resources for forever. Thank you. Yeah, well, there's a lot of questions, so I will start by answering the question from yourself about the sources of information. Well, I mean, to start with, if you all leave your email contacts at the back, there is a Canadian-wide mailing list that where we provide information about, or rather people here in Canada provide information about both events and things that are happening in Venezuela, updates and so on. I will also recommend you to look at the Hands of Venezuela website, which is handsofvenezuela.org, where we also try to provide information about forthcoming events and political analysis of what is happening in Venezuela. And there's a whole number of sources of information in English that are good. It's a website called venezuelanalysis.com, and there is another one, this is called vheadline.com, and there's a whole number of other places where you can find information. And because things are changing quite fast in Venezuela, it's worth keeping an eye on what's happening on a regular basis. And also to reply to the other question about the media, most media outlets internationally are aligned against Chavez. And you can recognize this. I mean, anytime they publish an article, they say the controversial Venezuelan leader, or the Chavez who organized the coup in 1992, things like that, you know. They always attach this little tag at the end of the article where they're implying that, well, Chavez is authoritarian, that he's mad, and things like that, you know. So, and this is most of the media that are doing this, both the so-called serious media, the not-so-serious media, everybody. And there is one reason for this, apart from the fact that most of the media internationally is dominated by a few big groups that have the same interests as the oligarchy in Venezuela. On top of this, the foreign correspondents in Venezuela are a small clique of people who live in around the Altamira Square in the wealthy areas in the east of Caracas, that they never leave the wealthy middle class environments, and they have completely biased view of what is happening in Venezuela. And I know some of them. I'm talking about of experience, and they are all friends and pals and the drinking mates and stuff like that. So they all create this news that are not news at all. And there's some really scandalous examples of this. In Venezuela itself, the whole of private media is still dominated by the opposition, with maybe one or two exceptions of newspapers that are more neutral or more balanced and so on. So also the lie that Chavez is trampling on the freedom of the press is completely exposed by the fact that the media still publish on a regular basis articles, opinion articles, editorial articles, and all sorts of articles where they call for Chavez to be overthrown by a military coup. Now, if this was to happen in any other democratic country, the editor and the journalist will be put on trial for incitement to rebellion or something like this. In Venezuela, no, these people continue to publish all the lies and provocations that they want. At the same time, there's been a state news information services have been promoted, and this is an interesting thing that has happened. For instance, they have created a second state TV channel that's called VBTV, and everybody who works there come from the community media, from community radio stations, from community TV stations, and so on. Not only this, but many of them now that are working in VBTV, they come from the actual revolutionary movement, from the communities. They have made an effort of going into the communities, training people on how to use a camera, and they become journalists without ever going to a media school. And this is really good channel. And not only this, but the channel is run by the people who work there. They have general assemblies. They decide what kind of programs they want. They decide what kind of news they want. And they also involve the communities about which they are reporting into the actual workings of inner functioning of the TV station, which is a very, very interesting development. In fact, the head of the main state TV channel now is Blanka Ikaut, who became famous for being the head of the main revolutionary TV station, KTA TV, just a few years ago. And she's trying to introduce some of the methods into the state TV channel with more or less success. Now, in relation to, it's been a question about the indigenous movement. Well, in Venezuela, the indigenous movement is not as important as it is in other countries like, say, Peru, Ecuador, or so on, where the majority of the population come from an indigenous background. This is not the case in Venezuela, so this is not a big part of the Bolivarian movement. But nevertheless, a number of measures have been implemented in order to recognize political rights to indigenous people. In fact, the president of the National Assembly, Noeli Pocaterra, comes from an indigenous background, and this is recognized in the constitution, and particularly in the south, in the Amazonian area, there's quite a lot of programs in order to develop self-government for indigenous people and so on. And in general, this has been quite a successful campaign, although there are also some conflicts in the border with Colombia, where some of the indigenous groups come from. This is a place which is bordering with Colombia, as I said, where all the problems of the dirty war in Colombia are spilling over onto the Venezuelan side. Many of the National Guards units in that region are controlled by the paramilitaries in Colombia. They use the border for the illegal activities, and this influences badly on the position of the indigenous people. There has also been a question about the ideological basis of the movement. Well, ideological basis of the movement, I don't think anybody knows. I mean, you ask 100 people in Venezuela and they'll give you 100 different answers. What is the basic motor force of the movement is basically the idea that the natural resources should be under the hands of the people, that people should decide over their own future. And in relation to Bolivar, well, the idea that people should be free from imperialism, and also, very importantly, the idea of Latin American unity, which was proposed by Bolivar 200 years ago. After his death, the different oligarchies in the different countries broke down the continent in 22 republics that are all dominated by United States multinational interests. So this is a very powerful idea, the idea of anti-imperialism and so on. And obviously, as the movement develops, more advanced ideas are also coming to the fore. Now the debate about socialism and so on. The problem is, in my opinion, that, and in this I agree with the comrade who's asked about the cult of personality, that there is only one living figure in this revolution, that is Hugo Chavez. This is practically the only person who has at the leadership of the movement any authority over the movement, the people recognize as their leader. Many of the other leading figures are quite discredited, particularly the leading figures in the different political parties that are part of the government, with some exceptions. There are some, for instance, some ministers who are more popular because they are seen as more responsive to pressure from below and the demands of the people and so on, but many of them are quite discredited. And the only person who has really an influence, political authority over the movement, is Hugo Chavez himself. Now, is this a positive thing or a negative thing? Well, I will say it's a negative thing. And many people in the Bolivarian movement will tell you that one of the main weaknesses of the Bolivarian movement is precisely the lack of an organization. Chavez himself has tried on a number of occasions to create a democratic organization that could be the channel for the movement to go forward. For instance, he first started by proposing this thing of the MVR 200, then the MVR, then he proposed the Bolivarian circles, which were community-based organizations and so on. But every single time this has failed, for one reason or another, mostly because the other leading figures within the Bolivarian movement in the different parties and so on have started a big battle over careers, influence, power, and so on. They have destroyed these organizations. So what is really missing, in my opinion, is an organization that brings together all these different organizations that already exist. There is no lack of organization in Venezuela. People are quite well organized at different local level, at the factory level, at the school level, and so on. But what is missing is a nationwide organization that brings together delegates, representatives from all these different organizations, and that has a decision-making power through which experiences that are taking place in one occupied factory or in one rural area can be shared by the whole movement, and the whole movement can formulate its own policies in a democratic way and can go forward in that way. And in my opinion, Chavez is not opposed to that. He will be very much in favor of something like this happening. But the revolution is not the task of one single person. And however good and honest Chavez is, and however much he has brought the process up to this point, which is already quite a lot, because many in his position, subject to such massive pressures, will have already capitulated, sold off, or as is the case in many Latin American countries, will have maybe just disappeared from political life. There's many cases in the history of Latin America, political leaders who tried to face up to imperialism were subjected to such pressure that they committed suicide. It's the case, for instance, in Peru, in Brazil, in Cuba, in other places like that. However much he has been a very progressive, very positive leader for this revolution, the more the revolution comes to a crucial point, the more the question of the democratic self-organization of the mass of working people is more important, because you cannot run a whole revolution in a country like this on the basis of one single person. So this becomes a more acute necessity. For instance, the workers in the occupied factories have now for the first time created a national revolutionary front of occupied factories. The main idea is to share out their experiences, to coordinate the movement, to spread the movement to other factories, and to create the basis precisely for this, for democratic control and planning over the whole of the economy. Also as a training school for workers to be able to run the economy by themselves. Now, in relation, again, to the question of the cult of the personality, I will also say this, that for the overwhelming majority of the people in Venezuela, the reason why they like Chavez so much is because he is the person who has brought them into political life for the first time. For many of them, they got their political education from Chavez. They have been awoken to political life through this movement, which they identify with Chavez. And this is the reason why so many people have put so much faith and trust in Chavez. But at the same time, this does not mean that if, say, Chavez takes a decision that goes against the will or the instinct of the masses, that they will follow him. For instance, there's been a number of occasions in which there's been strong criticism of Chavez, even by the most fanatic, if you want to call them like that, Chavistas. One of these occasions was when he came out in the presidential balcony after the coup and he said people should go back home and there should be national reconciliation. I'll give you one example, because I met this woman, person who never been involved in politics before, had been just participating in the Bolivarian movement, who has a picture of Chavez in his living room, and then was also a very religious person, not particularly inclined to violence. And she said to me on one occasion, she said, look, when I saw Chavez coming out in that presidential balcony with the constitution in one hand and a crucifix on the other hand, I said, this is a bad sign. We don't want national reconciliation. Chavez should be coming out here with the sword of Bolivar unleashed, and should we start chopping the heads of the opposition coup plotters, which I think is quite an interesting idea, let's put it that way. I mean, these people should at least be in jail. So there was strong criticism of Chavez at that time. The trust that the masses put on Chavez is because so far Chavez has expressed what they wanted to hear, and Chavez has responded to their pressure. So far, so far, so good. The moment that Chavez turns, say, if Chavez was to turn around against the interest of the masses, they will probably move away from Chavez. The other point was when he accepted the recall referendum in April 2004. The opposition had not collected the necessary signatures to call a recall referendum. And there was a lot of tension, and the Bolivarian movement, quite a lot of people came out on the streets to oppose the concession of a recall referendum to the opposition because they had not fulfilled the legal requirements to get one. And Chavez finally said, yeah, let's go for a recall referendum. There was big opposition at that time. There were even demonstrations against the decision. And when Chavez had a big mass meeting, to organize the battle to win that recall referendum, and he thanked the people who had organized on the part of the Bolivarian movement the effort to prevent the opposition from getting enough signatures for the recall referendum, there was stony silence in the Bolivar Avenue. This was quite an impressive thing because there must have been about 200,000-300,000 people there, and Chavez asked for an applause for these people. And people thought that this had done a really bad job, and they were actually being removed from their positions, and nobody clapped. So what I'm trying to say is that, yes, people put a lot of faith in Chavez, but as the movement develops, also the political ideas, the political maturity of the movement develops. But this is a question that needs to be resolved, the question of a democratic organization, nationwide democratic organization of the movement. Otherwise, there is a big problem. On the other hand, there is also another observation about this, that if they kill Chavez, they don't know what's going to come, you know, because Chavez also, to a certain extent, has played the role of keeping the movement on an organized track, on an ordered footing, and so on. If they kill Chavez, there will be an explosion of anger that probably the oligarchy will regret ever having thought about killing Chavez, because then all bets are off and people are going for the whole lot. So what is holding the? No, first another question has been asked about Invepal and Alcasa. These are different models, obviously, because in Alcasa is a state-owned factory where workers' control is being introduced, is being discussed by the workers and so on. Invepal is different because it's a factory was declared bankrupt, the workers took it over. Now in Invepal, just so that you understand that none of these things that are very positive in themselves are without contradictions. In Invepal, a very bad situation developed because nobody gave any advice to these workers. So they started developing this idea, which can happen sometimes in experiences of workers' control, particularly the leading people who had been elected by the mass assembly. They had started developing this idea that the factory belonged to them, and that their aim was to get the factory more profitable so that the workers in this particular factory will get better wages, better conditions, and so on. When the original idea was not this, the original idea was that the workers will get decent wages and everything else will be reinvested in the community through social programs and so on. That is a more collective approach to the whole thing of whole idea of workers' management. Now, what happened was that this got distorted. But finally, in November last year, and a whole number of irregularities happened in relation to the accounts and so on. In November last year, a mass workers' assembly in Vepal decided to remove the people they had elected as the directors of factory previously and put all the people they trusted in. So this also shows that, yes, there are problems of bureaucracy, there are problems of corruption, like in any revolutionary situation, but the only solution, as many of the workers are arguing now, is real workers' control and accountability, and that all people that are elected to positions are recallable at any time and accountable to the mass assemblies that have elected them. This is the only solution, the only safeguard that there is against the development of corruption and bureaucracy. There's been another question about the development of communal councils. This is a very, very recent thing. There was a previous attempt with local councils of councils of local planning and participation. I can't remember the whole name, but now there's new councils have been created that organize about 200 families, an area where 200 families live, These are based on direct democracy, mass assemblies, and they have power over decisions that affect this particular area. Be sewage, roadworks, street lighting, rubbish collection, a whole number of decisions are being handed over to these communal councils. Yeah, and this is an attempt to solve another of the major problems that the revolution is facing, and that is that this is a revolution that has left intact, or mostly intact, the old state apparatus. You see, for instance, the Ministry of Labor. There is a very progressive minister at the top. It's now been changed by another one. But the whole structure of the ministry, people who work in this ministry are still the same people that were working there before. Most of them are in the pockets of the employers. So many of them do take decisions in favor of the employers and nobody checks them. In fact, inside the Ministry of Labor, there is a political team. The minister and people who are loyal to the Bolivarian Revolution, they meet separately from the structures of the ministry to decide policies, to watch over saboteurs within the ministry and so on. So it's a very peculiar situation. And there is an awareness that this is a problem, that you cannot have a revolution maintaining the same old state structure, the judiciary, the legal system, the people who actually work in these ministries, the functionaries, and so on. You can't do it. And it's been proven in practice in Venezuela. In fact, the social plans, for instance, social programs, for instance, in relation to education and health, they are not run by the education ministry or the health ministry. It would have been impossible to implement them in this way. There was an appeal for the self-organization of the people, for volunteers to come for the literacy programs, for the communities to look for the rooms where these programs were going to be implemented, and the communities organized themselves. And the state provided the money through the oil company for this to happen. So there is already a certain kind of parallel structure. But unless you remove the old structure, this is still an obstacle. There's an obstacle that has to be overcome at some point or another. This also a little bit answers the problem in relation to the question of bureaucracy in the movement. Revolution needs to go further. This is completely clear. There is one other area in which the revolution is advancing, and this is the area of the armed forces, because in Venezuela the army was largely purged after the coup and after the sabotage. It was not so much purged by the decision of the movement, but because these generals and reactionary officers, they came out, they declared themselves in rebellion, they went to the Altamira Square, they stayed there for 100 days, and so they are now outside of the army, they put themselves outside of the army. But again, the army is still the same old army with a structure, a vertical structure of command. And so, despite the fact that quite a lot of the reactionary generals have been removed, the generals that are in place now are loyal to Chavez. It is not clear how long they're going to be loyal, whether they can be bought off, as there's been attempts, or not, whether they will go to the next stage of the revolution if more serious questions are posed, and so on. And in order to partially solve this problem, they have created a structure of militias, popular militias, by which there's an attempt of getting 200,000 people to get military training. These are people who come from the barrios, from the workplaces, from the poor communities, getting military training, getting organized in popular militias, and getting weapons in order to resist foreign invasion. But in my opinion, also in order to undermine any possibility of a military coup coming from the structures of the army. And this is already happening. People are already training. Venezuela has bought about 100,000 Kalashnikovs from Russia for an army of 80,000 people. So it's clear that the Kalashnikovs are to replace the old Belgian assault rifles that they are using. These are probably going to be given over to the popular militias. And this is also another thing that is being debated. There are still many things that are not clear in Venezuela. But at least these things are being posed, being discussed in the movement. I think that the movement needs to go forward. My opinion is that the movement needs to go forward in a number of directions. One, to take over the whole of the main basis of the economy, the banks, distribution of food, telecommunications, and put them under democratic control of the workers and working people of Venezuela in the benefit of the majority of the people. The private owners of these industries and economic resources have already shown once and again that they are not prepared to accept the democratic will of the majority, and therefore these resources should be taken away from them. Second line that the revolution should move forward, in my opinion, is that it should move forward to disband the old state apparatus and replace it by a democratic structure based on popular assemblies, mass assemblies at the workplaces, and elected and recallable delegates at all levels, local level, communal level, regional level, statewide level, and national level. And that this will provide a strong basis for the revolution to develop. And third, it should develop in an internationalist way. That is, the revolution cannot remain isolated in Venezuela, despite the fact that Venezuela is a country that is in a better position to sustain a revolution than Cuba was, for instance, because it's oil wealth and so on. But it needs to spread to other countries, because Venezuela is part of a regional economy, is part of the world economy. And unless the enemies of the revolution are defeated on a worldwide level, they will come back again. Now, some will say, and in Venezuela this argument is being discussed, some will say that this radicalization of the revolution will bring a U.S. intervention. And the reply to this is very easy on two accounts. One is that the U.S. intervention, there has already been, because the coup was not organized in Venezuela, it was organized in Washington. So, I mean, the revolution is already a danger for U.S. imperialism. There's no point in saying, let's moderate the revolution so there's not a danger. The very fact that there is a revolution is a danger. So the only way to prevent foreign intervention is to put an end to the revolution. And this is not what the people want. Secondly, by having a conscious orientation to the United States, to working people in the United States, to the Latino community in the United States, which is something that's being done. I don't know if you're aware of this, but Venezuela is selling oil, cheap fuel, to poor communities in the United States, in places like Chicago, Minneapolis, and other places where people are freezing to death in the winter. Venezuela is providing cheap oil to the poor communities through church organizations, NGOs, and other organizations in an attempt to prove that, well, I mean, these policies can also be applied here in the United States, and we are not against the Venezuelan, the U.S. Population, we are against the U.S. administration that is meddling into the affairs of Venezuela. And also, as you've seen probably in the last few weeks, there's a mass movement of the Latino immigrants in the United States. The demonstrations on Monday were really, really huge on a work day. So there was a mass walkout from workplaces and other actions like this. The official police figure for the demonstration in Los Angeles is 1.4 million people. This is the official police figure. So this is a mass movement that is obviously influenced by what is happening in Venezuela. And it shows that in the United States, there is also a division between a wealthy minority that rules the country, the overwhelming majority of the population who have different interests that are probably closer to the interest of working people in Venezuela. And this must be exploited. So what I will say is that so far, the Venezuelan revolution is already a source of inspiration. Source of inspiration for those who are fighting for a better society, not only as something that is happening in Venezuela, a faraway country of which we know little, but is an inspiration for our struggle, our daily struggle in our trade unions, in our schools, in our universities, in our communities, for a better world. A world that is not run in the interests of a wealthy minority that controls power, the economy, and they have privileges out of that, but a democratic society in which the economy, the wealth that is produced by working people is put in the hands of working people, in the interests of the working people, and is run democratically. This society has a name, it's socialism. And Venezuela has been raising this debate about socialism, and even Chavez has raised it, even though he has no formal training in socialism or anything like that. He's reached this conclusion out of his own experience. He has raised it as an urgent thing. He has said, look, if we allow this to go on for any longer, capitalism will destroy the planet that we live in. The question of socialism is not a question for 50 years or 100 years. The question is posed now. And now there is a chance, with all these movements that are going on around the world, some places in a more advanced way, in some places in a more slow way, but that they're happening everywhere. to take this struggle forward. And this opportunity has only come once in a generation. There's probably people here who participated in the previous wave of this struggle, but now it's our turn, and I think that we should put all the necessary means so that this time this movement is not defeated, but is victorious, and a victory in one country can then spread to other countries. Thank you.